sure what response Robert McNamara expected last year after the publication of his book, In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, or if he thought about it at all. His analysis of the war, seen by some as a mea culpa, was met with a storm of both praise and criticism from politicians, veterans, columnists, and reviewers. The paperback edition just out from Vintage Books includes a good deal of that response in its appendix, with around 100 pages of editorials and columns devoted to analyzing, hailing, or condemning Mr. McNamara. He joins me now to talk about the book, the surrounding debate, and the war, and I'm very pleased that he joins me now on New York & Company. Hello.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure you had very personal reasons for writing this book and that you would have written it no matter what the response, but did you get what you expected, or did you expect what you got?
I think, in a sense, I got more than I expected, not in the, I'll call it the quality or the range of response, but rather in the quantity. The book was on the bestseller list, number one, for weeks. It was chosen by the Book of the Month Club and the History Book Club. And all of this, to be frank with you, rather surprised me. It pleased me because my objective was twofold. Number one, well, first let me say, I didn't believe our country had yet come to grips with Vietnam. I don't think it has even to this day. But I wrote the book because the wounds are unhealed and the learning process has not been fulfilled. And I wrote the book to address both of those issues. And the response indicated it was doing that, and for that I was pleased.
It's interesting because every so often we hear that Vietnam has been put to rest once and
for
all. Yeah, and it's obvious that that's not the case.
It's obvious it hadn't been. That's correct.
Some of the criticism and praise had nothing at all to do with the book or your thoughts on the war. It was really about you as a man.
Well, there was some of that, but most of it, the criticism and the praise. And by the way, to go back just one second to your point on the appendix, I put it in.
That was your decision.
It was not only my decision, it was my idea. And I put it in because I wanted the American people to understand the range of opinion that still exists. And I tried to be as honest as I could in selecting it. There are 18 pieces. They begin with very harsh criticism. Very, very harsh criticism, an editorial from the New York Times, for example, and it extends through very, very warm praise. And I think the reader of the book, given that appendix, can put Vietnam in context, the way our people think of it today.
That New York Times editorial, which was on April 12, 1995, seemed designed to give you bad names.
Sure tried.
Mr. McNamara must not escape the lasting moral condemnation of his countrymen. He must hear the ceaseless whispers of those poor boys in the infantry dying in the tall grass, platoon by platoon, for no purpose.
And he went on to say I was sent to a, quote, sinecure, unquote, in the World Bank and to Martha's Vineyard. I don't know quite what that had to do with the book.
What they wanted to say is that these other guys came home in body bags or dead or psychologically damaged, and you went on to a very happy life.
But what they didn't recognize in that editorial and what many of the other commentators emphasized was that the American people, had not yet learned the lessons of Vietnam. And that is one of the major objectives of the book. The last chapter focuses on lessons. That was a purpose, because I don't think we had then, and I don't think even today we have, and we're not applying them today in parts of the world, China, Bosnia, whatever. So that is a major objective of the book.
Interestingly also, the same things that elicited the condemnations also elicited praise. People talked about your candor and your willingness to look at mistakes that you had made.
That is correct, and I appreciate that. And the what I call the warm praise came from some extraordinarily well-informed, knowledgeable people. A professor of history at Harvard, one of the greatest historians of the country, Ernest May, one of the great writers of the New York Review, Theodore Draper, who was very critical of the New York Times, as a matter of fact. In any event, the range of opinion is in that appendix, and I think that should orient the reader and stimulate thought of the reader.
I suspect that you were even more anxious about the response from veterans than you were from journalists.
Of course.
What have you heard from them? Obviously, you couldn't stick that in the appendix.
No, but I did. I wrote a new preface, and in the preface, I quote three of the people who suffered most from Vietnam. Ann Morrison, now Ann Morrison Walsh, the wife of the Quaker who burned himself to death under my window. Ron Kovich, the paraplegic veteran, the author of that very moving Born on the 4th of July. And Colonel Hackwood, who is the most decorated veteran of the Vietnam War.
He went into exile for a while in Australia.
That's right, exactly.
He was so angry.
But he is the most, I think he had 100 decorations, a true hero. But Ann Morrison, the Quaker, said, to heal the wounds of the war, we must forgive ourselves and help the people of Vietnam rebuild their country. I'm grateful to Robert McNamara for the book he has written. Ron Kovich said, over the long run, McNamara's book and his comments will promote healing. As Americans, we should all welcome it. And Hackworth said that he was critical in part, but he concluded by saying, McNamara's book is an important step toward understanding what happened, and it may help some of the walking wounded to move further along the healing path of forgiveness, and that's good for America's collective soul. So I think that's a range of opinion that all of us should recognize.
But there had to have been some people who said, look, there I was in the war, I got hurt, or I lost somebody, or whatever.
Or the wife said, I lost my husband.
And this was at a time when Robert McNamara already had decided this was not a winnable war.
Well, but it was also at a time when the leaders of the country and the majority of the people believed that we had to stay there to prevent what President Eisenhower forecast would happen if we lost, that is to say, the falling of the dominoes, the loss of Southeast Asia to communist control, which they believed would endanger the security of the United States and the West. That's why we stayed.
But the domino theory didn't work. There were a few local countries that fell, but Thailand was...
Again, let me refer back to that appendix. There's a review in the appendix by Walt Rostow, who was the National Security Advisor.
Who was a real hawk.
To President Johnson. Well, I don't want to characterize him as a hawk or dove, but I simply want to say, in this review, which appeared in the London Literary Supplement, it's now in the appendix, he says, we were right, we won. We needed to be there. If we hadn't been there, we would have lost Southeast Asia and our security would have been endangered. To this day, he believes. And by the way, I think Lee Kuan Yew, the former Prime Minister of Singapore, feels that to this day. Dean Rusk, the then Secretary of State, believed it up until the day he died about 2 years ago. And there's a very moving comment by his son in that appendix. So there's still dispute about whether we were wise to go in or not. I think we were unwise. I think we should learn from it. I've tried to lay out the lessons.
What's your feeling about the dominoes? Cambodia seems to have suffered an awful lot as a result
of
that war. Laos.
The dominoes didn't fall. Thailand didn't fall. Indonesia didn't fall. Malaysia didn't fall. Cambodia, I won't say fell, it just suffered.
Well, how much do you feel all of this was a result of the things that had happened earlier? Eisenhower, of course, was faced with a real problem when the French were defeated.
That's correct.
And Richard Nixon wanted to go in then, and Eisenhower said no. So on the first level, there was a reticence, especially from a general. Then JFK kind of eased us in. By the time we were in full-scale war, it felt like we were going down the slippery slope. It wasn't
Absolutely.
A real decision
in,
made.
In one chapter, I say we were on a slippery slope. You're absolutely correct. And the problem was, and this existed in Eisenhower's period as well as in Kennedy and Johnson's, there was tension and a conflict between two premises. The first premise was that if South Vietnam fell to North Vietnam, the security of the West was endangered, particularly the security of the U.S. That was a very strongly held belief by Eisenhower and the others involved. The second premise was, but the war can only be won by the South Vietnamese. Now, if it became clear the war couldn't be won by the South Vietnamese, and yet we still believed that the loss of Vietnam would endanger the security of the U.S., what should we do? That was the issue. And that's when we decided to put in American troops. And would Eisenhower have done it? I think the answer is yes, but it wasn't his decision. It was ours. You can't blame Eisenhower. He did advise President Kennedy and those of us who were in the room in a famous meeting the day before Kennedy was inaugurated, January 19, 1961. He advised in a way that indicated he believed, if necessary, to preserve Laos and South Vietnam from communist control, we should introduce U.S. forces. But it wasn't his decision. It was ours. You can't blame Eisenhower.
There's still a big debate over whether Kennedy would have withdrawn the troops had he lived. And it's interesting to see who says what. Mostly historians say, no, there's no indication. But the people who were in the administration who have their own images to burnish generally say yes.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, and I want to make very clear right now.
Well, you were there, but you have your mea culpa there.
I want to say very clearly now that I do say yes in the book. I think he would have withdrawn. I've been pressed to give an answer for 30 years. I refused to do it. One of the reasons I refused was I didn't want to burnish images, his or anybody else's. And in the book, I don't say I think he would have withdrawn to burnish his image, not at all. I say it because if he would have withdrawn and Johnson and the rest of us who had served with him didn't, then the burden is on me to say, why, if I think he would have withdrawn, when we all were serving with him, why didn't we withdraw? That's the reason I say it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to explain as I go along.
Why did you? If you knew that Kennedy was leaning in that direction.
I don't want to say he was leaning in the direction, although I mentioned a very important decision on October 2nd, just a few weeks before he died, October 2nd, 1963, in which I recommended that we set a limit for the employment of our troops in South Vietnam of the end of 1965, and then we withdraw the first 1,000. We then had 16,000 there. Withdraw the first 1,000 within 90 days by the end of 63. He approved that decision. I think it was an indication of his thinking at the time. But I hasten to add that was before CM was killed. It was before it appeared that the North Vietnamese were going to gain control to the degree it later appeared. How he would have responded to those changes, I can only speculate. I do speculate only for the purpose of trying to dramatize the issue. If I think he wouldn't have, why didn't we?
And he may have responded differently what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And by the way, on the Gulf of Tonkin,
that's one of the only changes you've made in the text.
I was just going to mention that. I did not change the text of the book. I added a preface and I added that very important appendix you mentioned. But I didn't change the text with the exception of one sentence. And I should mention for your audience that I went to Hanoi in November last year, and I should later tell you why. But while I was there, I met with General Giap, who was the defense minister throughout the Vietnamese War, and I asked him only one question. The room was just overrun with press, and I didn't want to get into a detailed discussion. But I said, Mr. Minister, did the second Tonkin Gulf attack occur? This was a very controversial issue at the time described in the book. And I finally concluded, as did the President, the Secretary of State, and so on, and the chiefs, that it had occurred at the time. But it was doubtful. I asked him. He said, no, it did not.
Mm-hmm. He admitted to the first one.
He admitted to the first one, but he said the second hadn't occurred. So I added one sentence.
My guest is Robert S. McNamara, and he has written, with the help of Brian Van Demark, In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. I'm sure you remember when that book was released last year, became a number one national bestseller. It's just been reissued in paperback by Vintage with a huge appendix and a new preface, and we will continue our conversation right after this. Robert S. McNamara is here. His memoir, are we calling this a memoir or a history?
It's a retrospective view, and I guess you'd call it a memoir.
Well, the book is called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, now available in paperback from Vintage with 100 pages of the response to the book, which is really important. And this is a worldwide response. You were talking about going to Vietnam after
yes.
the, and I wonder whether you apologize to the Vietnamese.
Oh my God, no! No, let me.
Do you feel any responsibility in that way? After all, this has been called McNamara's War
by
some.
I think apologies and are not appropriate at this time. That's not the issue. That's not why I went to Vietnam. I went to Vietnam because my hypothesis is that each of us, the Vietnamese and the U.S., missed opportunities either to avoid the war or stop it. And our failure to seize those opportunities was a tragedy for each of us. They say on their studies they lost 3,200,000 killed, 3,200,000 Vietnamese killed, military civilians north and south. We lost 58,000 killed. My belief is each of us could have achieved our geopolitical objectives without that tragic loss of life. If I'm correct, what were the opportunities we had to stop it and avoid that loss of life? Why didn't we seize them, each of us? Were they interested in talking about that? Yes. This would carry on the type of historical review that engaged the Soviets, the U.S., and the Cubans in reviewing the Cuban Missile Crisis, from which came some dramatic indication of how close the world came to nuclear war and some lessons of how to avoid that in the future. I think the same kind of a discussion could be carried on with the Vietnamese and the same type of lessons developed. I hope it will be.
Well, interestingly, the wars that occurred during the Cold War were all done with Soviet client states. We fought them. It was as though we were fighting the Soviet Union and at various times China as well through these other places. And we wound up turning it around with Afghanistan, the same sort of thing we did to them. But if there weren't a Cold War, maybe we wouldn't have had any of these things.
I think you're absolutely correct on that. You're absolutely correct. It was the Cold War that underlay the U.S. intervention in Southeast Asia. There's absolutely no question about that.
Well, let's say we had won that war, whatever that means. What would it have meant to the Cold War?
Well,
did anybody plan that far in advance?
I don't think we thought, I'll call it winning it, would have particularly strengthened the position of the West vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and the East. But I know that it was the common belief of all of the major military and civilian leaders of several administrations, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, that if we lost it, it would seriously endanger the security of the West, without any question. May I go back just 1 second, Howard, to your point about the wars were with Soviet client states? You're obviously correct if you look at Vietnam as an illustration, but Korea as well. But I also want to say,
and others, we got involved in Iran in another way.
You're quite right. But I also
Guatemala.
I also want to say we came during Cuba. during the time I was secretary, 7 years. We came within a hair's breadth of war with the Soviet Union itself on three separate occasions, and today that's not recognized, but. Unless you recognize that, you can't really understand the mindset of the Kennedy-Johnson administration. We came very close to war over the Soviet attempt to take West Berlin out from under NATO in August of 1961. Over their introduction of nuclear weapons into Cuba in October of 62, over their support of Egypt's attempt to eliminate Israel as a nation in June of 67. And by the way, in connection with that, the hotline was used for the first time, and one of the messages from Kosygin, the Soviet prime minister, to President Johnson said, in effect, if you want war, you'll get it. So that it was not just client states. It was direct confrontation with the Soviets that was present during much of that period.
But in all those cases, I get the feeling that the United States had no plan. It was just reacting. If anything, the Soviet Union, despite its problems, had a larger sense of its goals.
No, I don't agree with that.
I mean, this is all just cat and mouse, back and forth?
No, I don't agree we didn't have a plan. The U.S. had a plan. It goes back to 1947. It goes back to that famous...
George Kennan.
Exactly. It goes back to that famous article written under a pseudonym, Mr. X, and published in Foreign Affairs magazine in 1947, in which George Kennan laid out the containment policy. That was the U.S. strategy for almost 4.5 decades.
What was your consciousness of that? You were working at Ford at the time. Now, Ford was making military equipment, but were you at all conscious of the politics until you wound up in Washington?
No, I wasn't an expert. I certainly wasn't a geopolitical expert. I wasn't a military expert. I'd served in World War II. I'd been in the Army for 3 years. But I couldn't tell the difference between a nuclear weapon and a conventional weapon when I came down. And by the way, to digress again a moment, there is an appendix in the book that was part of the original book on nuclear weapons that I would urge every listener to read. At one point, I thought it was so important, I told several different audiences if they would buy the book and read the appendix, I'd pay for it. Well, several of them took me up on it. I no longer make that offer. But I do stress that nuclear weapons then and today are a major problem and a major risk for our country. We have not yet addressed. That's in the book. But to go back to...
And the defenders say that mad, mutually assured destruction is what has kept the world free of war for a long time.
That is right. And I wish the readers would read the appendix to read how close we came to nuclear war with the Soviet Union over Cuba in October of 62, and the weapons would have brought it about. They damn near brought it about. It wasn't...
Mm-hmm. The man wasn't really working.
But to go back to your point, what did I know as President of Ford about being Secretary of Defense? And the answer was very, very little. And at least I was wise enough to recognize that. And I told the president on several occasions, I turned down his offers, and I said I wasn't qualified. Finally, I loved the man, and this will illustrate one of the reasons I did. Finally, he said to me, look, Bob, he said, you know, there isn't any school for presidents either. By which he was simply saying he, in a sense, didn't feel fully qualified to be president. But secondly, having recognized that I had no experience other than as an officer in the Army that qualified me to be Secretary of Defense, I did obtain his permission to appoint the ablest people in the country to senior positions in the department. He never once violated that agreement, and the result was I had the strongest department of any cabinet officer in the history of the country.
My guest is Robert S. McNamara. He's written a book called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lesson of Vietnam, now available in paperback from Vintage. You're listening to New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've been under attack for all sorts of things, not just Vietnam War. A few years ago, a book came out which blamed you and a group of your military buddies for destroying American industry. They said that you and these other guys set into motion a changed attitude toward the quality of products to be produced. Do you remember that? And then we're responsible for the MBA systems.
Remember that, and it was just totally wrong. What actually happened, it's interesting. Let me take a moment on it. I was a very young assistant professor at Harvard when the war started, and I ended up in the Army. And
We're talking about World War II.
That's right. And I was on leave from Harvard the whole time. I couldn't wait to get back. And Harvard was very good to me while I was gone. They paid my insurance and so on. I had to borrow $100 from the dean to pay life insurance because for just 3 days. $10,000 life insurance. I flew over to Europe on a Pan Am Clipper. But in any event, at the end of the war, I wanted to go back. My wife was in the hospital with infantile paralysis, and finally I was persuaded I couldn't go back, couldn't pay her hospital bills, and a friend of mine was putting together a group to go to Ford Motor Company to assist Henry Ford, and I finally, against my better judgment, I agreed to join that group, and I went there. And it led to an extraordinarily interesting career. Ultimately, I became president of the company. But it was during that period that we introduced some of the reforms that led to the charges you're talking about. Ford Motor Company, you won't believe this. Ford Motor Company just barely broke even for 20 years, from 1926 to 46, including the war years. At a time, General Motors was making billions. So our job was to prevent the company from going bankrupt. It lost, as I remember it, $58 million in the first 8 months I was with it, say from January 46 to...
And $58 million was real money in those
days. It was real money, you're darn right. And our problem was to turn that company around financially, which we did.
Well, that book, I remember, suggested that some of the things you did at Ford, which turned it around, you then brought with you to the Department of Defense, and that messed up the Department of Defense.
On the contrary.
And then you were bringing in the wrong... I'm just telling you...
You have an
aura around you that you have to contend
with. The part of the problem was the aura that you mentioned. We were called the whiz kids because we did so much so fast to help turn around Ford Motor Company. And you're quite right. I did bring some of that into the Defense Department, and it was applied advantageously. We put in cost control programs that were extraordinarily successful. So I think that basic charge was wrong. And by the way, it's been withdrawn in effect in recent years.
Let's get back to the whole idea of planning. You suggest in this book that we really didn't have good long-range plans here, that we didn't have an idea of what our real goals were, and that caused a lot of trouble. Are you suggesting that if we had thought it out better, we would have gone into the war, but differently?
No, I think what I'm suggesting is that is slightly different from what you're talking about. It wasn't so much we didn't have a plan. We had the containment strategy, which I think was a sound strategy, but we didn't understand our opponents. And this is one of the lessons of Vietnam. Know your opponent. And I want to suggest to you, I don't think we understand to this day some of our opponents or potential opponents. Let's just take Muslim fundamentalists. I don't think we understand them. And this can be a very serious problem. I don't think we understand the Croats and the Serbs and the Muslims in Bosnia today. I don't think we understand.
And we're talking domino theory once again there.
Well,
aren't we?
Yeah. I wouldn't quite use the word domino.
Well, they're saying Greece will fall and Turkey will
fall. No, you're absolutely right. And at one point, I think the U.S. very properly sent Cy Vance to Macedonia to try to help Macedonia avoid the catastrophe that was engulfing Bosnia on the grounds that if Macedonia erupted, it would draw in Greece and Turkey and perhaps the whole southern end of NATO would collapse. So the particular point I want to make is I don't think it was so much lack of planning that was important. It was lack of knowledge of one's opponent and lack of judgment with respect to risks. We misjudged the Chinese threat. I'm absolutely certain of that.
But did we also misread Ho Chi Minh? There were many people who were saying at the time that this guy was in love with the United States, that he used the Bill of Rights in his own constitution, and he had offered many times to make some kind of a deal, and that we just kept on ignoring because we were so rigid in our thinking.
That's a very good point. I would just disagree with one phrase you used. Misread him at the time. The time we're now talking about is the 1960s. I don't think in the 1960s people were saying, you misread him. I think we may have.
We missed our opportunity in the
50s. That's the point I want to make. And in the 1950s and earlier, I think there was a chance that we could have avoided Ho Chi Minh falling under control of the communists. Your audience won't believe this. He was a pastry cook at the Savoy Hotel in London. He lived in France. He lived in the United States for a time. I think he either was or could have been a Tito rather than a servant of Khrushchev, which is the way we viewed him.
And now, in fact, Vietnam seems to have gone in that direction. It's neither Chinese nor Russian oriented.
It's very clear today. Number one, Vietnam wants to be independent of China. Number two, it wants to achieve the remarkable growth of those Asian countries, of which South Korea and Singapore are illustrative. And I think between today and 20 years from now, Vietnam may grow in the same way that South Korea did between 68 and 88.
Interestingly, at the time, defenders, people who didn't know better, said, well, this doesn't look good to me, but the government knows all sorts of things that we don't know. And that argument was used often against critics who were experts in the field.
Some. I wouldn't say it was used often, and I wouldn't say that it was that argument that led most of the people of the country to support what we did, which is the fact they did support it.
For a long time.
And again, there's some very interesting comments in the appendix, one by a a professor, political science professor at Chicago, wrote a book on the subject that showed that the majority of the people of the country and the press and the Congress supported the war up into 1968. I don't think that relieves us of the responsibility. Leaders are supposed to lead, not follow public opinion. We didn't lead in the right direction.
Well, how much do you feel that was not your role? Some people did quit government when they felt that the war was wrong.
A few.
But most people, I hate to invoke the name Albert Speer because that really suggests all sorts of other stuff, but most people do see government officials in a situation like this as being the good bureaucrats, the people who are doing what the president wants and trying real hard even if they have personal misgivings. And you obviously had personal misgivings because they're revealed in the Pentagon Papers.
Yes, well, that's true. But I was a free citizen. I could have resigned. I didn't.
Even after you really felt that this was an unwinnable war?
Yes. We can talk about why if you're interested. But I think two or three things, and I want to stress one in particular. I think every citizen of this country has a responsibility to the nation, to serve the nation when asked to do so. I feel very strongly about that. I have put no qualifications whatsoever on it. And I have no apologies for acting in accordance with that and believing it today. Secondly, I think on balance, America should be very proud of its public servants. And I know that's not a popular thing to say today, but I believe it. And I don't care whether they're Democrats or Republicans, whether they're in uniform or out of uniform. I was talking to a friend yesterday who had also served in a senior position in private industry. And we both agreed that those people we serve with in government worked harder and were at least as intelligent and competent as their counterparts in the private sector. I don't think our people believe it, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because we keep on being told that unless we pay them more, we're not going to get the top quality people.
No, but we pay them far less, as we should. I'm not arguing we should pay government more, but today the people in government receive, I'd say, 20% of what they could do in private sector.
We had Howard K. Smith on the show last week, and he supported the war a long time, sees himself as a liberal, but supported the war, felt that it was winnable up to fairly late, and that's when he gave up on the war. There are a lot of people who still think that that war was winnable. From the way I see it, I don't know if it ever could have been because we just didn't have enough of the people on our side.
Well, I think with hindsight, President Kennedy was right when he said only the South Vietnamese can win the war. I believe it. And that's one of the lessons. I don't think an external military force can win a civil war. And there was, whether it was primarily a civil war, there were major aspects of civil war that was part of it. And we ought to learn and understand that. And in a sense, it applies to Bosnia today. Not only cannot an external military force win a civil war, I don't think an external military force can reconstruct a failed government and a failed state. And we had a failed state in South Vietnam. And we were trying, in a sense, to reconstruct it. It couldn't be done. It can't be done in Bosnia.
And there are people who are concerned that all three of those states that are potential tinderboxes, Croatia, Serbia, and Bosnia, are headed up by dictatorial types who really could cause all sorts of problems beyond the conflicts with each other.
No question about it. And I want to make clear, I'm not arguing we should not have a NATO force in there today. That's not my point at all. I'm glad NATO is there. I'm glad we're part of it. But it has a very limited objective, and that's simply to separate the warring armies. It's doing that. Its objective is not to reconstruct a failed state. I don't think it's capable of that. It shouldn't undertake that objective. We should pull them out in December as we plan to.
Mm-hmm. But
that's a lesson of Vietnam.
Even though when we pull them out in December, it looks like they'll just go after each other again?
I hope they don't, but leaving them there is not going to prevent it.
Mm-hmm. This is something that really is not covered in your book, but I'm just curious if you've thought about this. At the time, the withdrawal was seen as a kind of a victory for the opponents of the war. The people on the left really thought that this country was going to move in a very different direction. augmented by rock and roll, Bob Dylan and people like that, this country was going to become quite different from what it had been in the past. And instead, we have moved in an opposite direction almost totally. It's become a very conservative country, and one in which I think a fair number of people who are in Congress these days feel that we were stabbed in the back in Vietnam. Isn't it weird that the legacy of the Vietnam War is a move to the right?
Well, I'm not sure that's the legacy of the Vietnam War, but I do believe that our country faces very, very serious problems today, social problems, economic problems, problems of our role in the world.
Are you a Democrat? You weren't when you went into the Kennedy administration, were you?
The president thought that I was a Republican. The fact is I had voted for him. He didn't know that. But he thought I was a Republican at the time. Am I a Democrat today? I believe we should be pursuing many of the programs that the Democrats put forward. For example, I think it's a disgrace that the richest country in the world allows 40 million of its people to receive inadequate health care. I think it's a disgrace that in the capital of the richest country in the world, I doubt that your audience will believe this, but it's true, in the capital of the richest country in the world, the infant mortality rate is twice that of Castro's Cuba. This is disgraceful. Now, I could go on and on. I just ran into UN representatives while I was waiting to come into your studio. They are here in one of your other studios to put the case of the UN forward. The U.S. is a deadbeat with respect to the UN. We haven't paid our peacekeeping assessments. We haven't paid our general operations. Whatever facet of our life you look at, we're in trouble today. We've got to deal with our domestic problems.
Well, there are people out there who believe the UN is a world government that is trying to dominate the United States.
And I know it isn't.
Well, we learned an awful lot about what happened during the Vietnam War from this book, and I'm very grateful that you've been here and been so open today.
Oh, you're very kind to invite me.
The book is called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, reissued now in paperback with a 100-page appendix that has all of the reviews, the letters. In fact, it even has Robert McNamara's replies to some of the criticism of him after the hardcover had been published. It has a new introduction, and it even has one correction of fact about the Gulf of Tonkin. My thanks to you, Mr. McNamara, for being on New York & Company today.
I'm grateful to you. We'll be right back.